This episode of Yes But Why Podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
Reductress does like open calls for submissions, and I put together like 10 headlines. And they bought one of them, and that was like the first piece I did, and still one of my favorite things I've ever written. It kind of just went from there. And then, like, you know, I made a friend who was writing for the Hard Times who recommended me, so I started pitching and writing there, and then, you know, made connections there, and it kind of just expanded. The nice thing about humor writing is that the bar to entry is really low. Like, the New Yorker will read your submission. And so you, like, you don't need anything but a great piece to start out.
Do you suggest writing like one piece to then shop around so that people see what you can write first, or do you submit pitches?
It depends on the site. Like, a lot of places are more headline focused, and they just want a funny headline. And then I feel like there's sites like McSweeney's is more of like a site for people who read the article. Although I know they want to have a funny headline also, but so yeah, it just varies. But I think for both the New Yorker and McSweeney's, which are, you know, prestigious humor sites, you have to write the piece. So I've submitted less to those because I'm very lazy and I like just writing a headline and then seeing if it gets.
Well, it can also be very hard as well to come up with a full thing before you know that it's going to be accepted. Like, especially in this world where, you know, a lot of stuff changes minute by minute. Like, there's just no way to know, you know, if I write this now and start submitting it in 2 weeks, is this like either old news or like, you know, a passe way of thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. If it's timely, you have to get stuff out right away. I also think there's some value if you're just pitching somewhere and having a little bit of idea vetting. Because I would say I have ideas all the time that I think are funny that like don't do well. And so even just getting a layer of, like, somebody being like, this is funny, this isn't, here's the good one, is, like, you know, then you wind up writing the thing that is going to be funny to, like, a wider number of people.
Sure. And that's, like, the publications are telling you what's good and bad, not, like, a third party that you're asking to help, right?
Yeah.
Oh, right on, right on.
Although sometimes I run stuff by friends, but...
Yeah, but that's
yeah,
what you
no,
mean. Yeah.
I mean... Like an editorial, an editor, like, looking at something and being like, yeah, man, write this.
Man, bless them for doing all the work to respond and everything. Like, you'd think that there'd just be a lot of, like, no, 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 as opposed to, like, here are some helpful tips. It's like, wow, that's so great that they care so much.
Oh, no, they never, it's often just no. Yeah, so the feedback, but, I mean, no is feedback also.
Yeah,
so
right.
It, like, tells you something about the headline. Yeah. I mean, it is, it's true. You have to both believe and disbelieve feedback at all times, right? Because, like, you write one thing and maybe, like, it gets a no and then the next place picks it up. But if you get, like, three no's, I feel like then it's usually time to move on and do something else.
So how did you, since you mentioned at the beginning that you weren't so much into writing, How do you feel about doing that now and sort of sticking to it since that first one went through? Do you feel more like a writer now, or is this just something that, like, is a helpful way to spread the funny even without having to go to an open mic?
I do like it, and I think I've done more of it because open mics in LA are so terrible. So it's like, I think like satire, which is, it has like a reasonably quick turnaround and sometimes a very quick turnaround if it's timely, it like can be a fun way to make a topical joke and get something out like a movie.
Yeah, without having to deal with the rigmarole.
Yeah.
So since you've been in Los Angeles, you have you've been performing, but you say the open mics are not so great. Is it that they're not so welcoming, or is it like there's kind of a home team advantage? Like, hey, I've been here for, you know, 10 years. What are you doing, newbie?
No, it's not either of those things. It's just that a lot of the open mics are not. So the purpose of an open mic is to do something new, right, and get feedback on whether it's funny.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the open mics in LA are so bad that they do not provide that, like, fundamental characteristic. So, I mean, I guess at the base level, it's just, like, reciting some words you practice for fun, but then it's like, you know, the feedback, stand-up is all about that feedback loop, and that feedback loop just doesn't exist in some places.
So, like, people aren't responding, or they're, like, just sitting there thinking about their own jokes, so they're not reacting
to
yours?
Yeah, because it's, like, five comedians in a room under bad conditions who are not there for jokes.
Yeah. Yeah, I felt like that a lot when I lived in New York City. I mean, the open mics that I went to were great in the way that it felt like a bunch of friends hanging out in a room together, but I don't know that I particularly learned that much in the way of how to tell a joke and what to get better at while I was there. I felt deeply supported, but I just was like, but you guys love everything I do? Okay, I feel like that's not great, but cool.
yeah, so it's really just like, and then some of them are like, there's a lot of bucket straws. So you, like, don't even know if you're going to go up. And then you have to, like, take the time to drive somewhere in Los Angeles, which is a nightmare.
Oh, yeah. That's
so
weird.
In that case, there's absolutely not a feedback loop because you don't even perform.
Oh, yeah. That's so
So this is
weird.
Not universally true, but those are a couple of reasons why things are bad and you just have to, like, you know, ask around and figure out what the, like, what good place that will provide, like, some semblance of that.
How have you been working on new material then? Are you just essentially getting booked on shows and trying new stuff amidst already jokes that you know already work just to see how they go?
I have been doing that more, which is kind of a bad thing to do. I'm like, I'm doing a bad thing when I do that.
Well, I mean, I don't know about that. I mean, famous people are expected to be polished the first time they go out. So people, like, go up to them and, like, harass them for jokes that they're trying to work on too. One imagines then that most of their stuff is considered quote unquote polished, even if they're making it up. So I think it's kind of a, you got to do what you got to do. I mean,
part of why famous comedians like later specials wind up just like being less good is that they're not performing for difficult crowds basically ever.
Yeah.
And it's just impossible to write good material if you're not working.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're getting too much like enthusiasm, you're like, no, but tell me what's not funny about it so I can make it better. Don't just laugh.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So tell me, have you been doing comedy or, you know, being funny your whole life? Or was that something that you picked up later after, you know, school and whatnot? Or did you do that as a little kid?
So I would say I've been funny my whole life, although I will say when I was younger, and I think this is part of like the ways in which I'm funny and part of just being a woman is like people kind of don't encourage you to think of yourself as funny.
Yeah.
I feel like throughout my life, people have just been like, oh, she's a really good writer, but not like, oh, this really made me laugh. You're very funny. You know, like, I feel like that's just like the different way women get complimented.
Hmm.
But like now looking back at my life, I can see it, like, I feel like I was always writing like little funny things or like adding jokes into my school assignments or like, you know, I feel like in middle school, I wound up writing like humor pieces, but I like didn't really think of them that way because I didn't even know that was a real thing. And then I like did improv in college, but I'm not good at improv. It wasn't until I started doing stand-up that I everything kind of clicked together and I started thinking about what I do as more like comedy first.
Hmm. So you started with improv in college. What made you sign up for that?
I was like a theater kid, so I had done improv in like high school and middle school. You know, like when you play like an improv game with your theater group.
Oh, sure. I'm older than you, so they didn't really offer improv in my high school situation. But I appreciate and I'm glad that you did, that it was for you.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even remember the environments I did it in, but I definitely remember playing like improv games or like, you know, maybe we like went to an elementary school and did improv for them. And now that I say that sounds like a complete nightmare.
I'm sure it is, but they laugh, you know, you make a couple fart jokes and they're in, it doesn't matter.
Sure.
You can talk about anything. If you're like, they're like, oh, this is great. That's what I find with the
So I think there's like, obviously, like I enjoyed performing, but I'm also not a great actor. And so like improv was close enough.
Yeah.
I'm not like the worst at improv. I'm just not like never going to be a great improviser.
Oh, sure. Well, the way you told the story, it sounded like you were, you know, kind of funny, but mostly in writing and papers and whatnot. And then all of a sudden in college, you know, you had done improv and I was all like, maybe, you know, who knows? So a lot of people use improv for different things. And like, I've known, you know, various people who were like in a like super intense college program and somebody suggested they needed to chill out and that's why they took improv. So I just wondered if perhaps, you know, you were like studying too hard and needed to like, you know, calm down. And so you took some improv, but yeah, so you did.
No,
some theater.
I've always enjoyed, like, I liked making people laugh for sure. And like, I've always been like kind of funny in person too, although in a lower key way than like the funny guy vibe.
You know, I guess so, but I'm going to be honest with you. I've interviewed a lot of people and I'm pretty intimidated of you, Ella. I was thinking about talking to you today and I was probably more nervous than I've been with a lot of people. So, you know, you're real funny.
So, that's such a nice compliment, Amy. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, you're pretty great. I consider you sort of like high level comedy in a way that it's like, well, other people will get there, you know, but yeah, I mean, so don't ever worry about being less than or anyone thinking that. I feel like you're held to a very high regard, both by myself and lots of other people that have seen you perform before.
Oh, that's kind of you to say.
Absolutely. I mean, you're great. And I think it's important in my life. And that's kind of why I do improv, because I think I like sharing positivity. And that's how I interpret yes and. So when I see something nice and I want to make sure that people know about it, that's why I try to say it. So anyway, I just wanted you to know that you were cool. And also, I'm a little nervous to chat with you. So, but tell me more about your first time getting into stand-up. You said that felt comfortable. How old were you? When did you first do your first set?
So I'd been doing a little bit of improv. This was in Austin. And I decided to do something crazy on my birthday. and I took like a one night, one time only stand up for improvisers class. Because I thought it would, I literally just was like, oh yeah, I want to do something like wild. Cause like the year before that I had moved to Austin on my birthday and I was like, oh, I have to continue this tradition of like doing something very crazy.
Oh my God, that's so high. That's like force yourself to do crazy things. You're like, all right, I'm turning 47. Let's jump out of this plane. It's like, you don't have to. Relax. It's fine.
Yes. So I did it as like a, yeah, kind of, like for sure on a whim. I like didn't have any expectations, just looking for a fun activity. And then, because I'm not even like, a lot of comics came up and they have their whole list of like, people they idolized as kids, but like in terms of stand-up, I watched like Eddie Izzard's specials and Robin Williams' special, and that was it. Like, I wasn't consuming a lot of stand-up as a kid.
It's very clear what your and parents so, thought were funny.
yeah, but even that, it's like, even like they weren't stand-up people. So like Eddie Izzard was from my sister who introduced me, and like yeah, so just not a big comedy fan household. And like it hadn't really occurred to me, and then I tried it and I just like it was immediately like so compelling. Yeah. It's still my favorite thing I've ever done. I still love doing it.
Yeah. So as far as classes go, did you take, you said that you'd been taking improv classes and then you decided to take the stand up for improv class. Did you immediately like let go of the improv that you were doing because you had finally actually found the thing that jazzed you the most?
No, I did improv for like another year or two. I was on I was in a musical improv troupe called That Racket for a little bit, and it was extremely fun. I really loved the people. It was just like a good time. And then I think eventually, like, I was working full time, and I had gotten really serious about stand up, and just like something had to give.
Yeah, wow. I mean, the output alone of a musical improv troupe is super intense, but you've prefaced your improv work with, I wasn't very good at it. And wow, I mean, musical improv is like the hardest possible thing to do. How'd you get into that?
So I would recommend this highly to any Austin improviser. I took the singing improv classes at Merlin Works.
Awesome.
Which are, so I don't know if you ever got to take a class from Aiden, but she was an incredible teacher, taught my 101, and Shayna Merlin is also wonderful. And yeah, those awesome. Classes are just like the like pure form of improv that's like playful and joyful. Really, really great. Would recommend to anybody.
That's so great. That's so
And you
amazing.
you do like really have to let go of your like ego and fear of being an idiot. Because you kind of have to be an idiot.
Man, the break even for a moment from the ego is so valuable. How great. I'm so glad. Shayna's wonderful. I've heard nothing but great things from everyone who's ever taken classes from her. And when I chatted with her for this podcast, she was just a ray of sunshine. I love her so much. I'm so
glad.
Yeah,
Shayna's incredibly talented, and she's like a powerful businesswoman. Very good.
Yeah, very. In fact, it makes me feel super empowered as a woman. Whenever I see her stuff, I'm like, yeah, she's doing it. It's amazing. Yeah. She was like, she's doing it for me.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, man. So you're in the hardest improv thing. You're having a great time, though, which is so wonderful. And then you get into stand-up and decide to focus on that. Where did you find your first home? Like, did you go to the same open mic every week? Did you have, like, a schedule? How did you find your way? I don't know about you, but, I mean, I personally only have occasional connections to the stand-up community. So I don't have like a certain crowd unless they're sort of improv friendly crowd. What was the crowd that you found? How'd you find your stand-up family and keep it going?
I mean, I just went to the website Laughing Gas and looked at it and went to the open mics on it. And the nice thing about Austin is that's not like, you know, stuff will come and go, but that's, there's not like an overwhelming number of mics and shows. The first one I ever went to was a shtick run by Maggie May at Cold Town. And that still happens. It's called Stage Dive now, but Mondays at 10. And I got to do it the last time I was in Austin, and it was like a real throwback moment. Amber Bixby runs it now. And so that was fun. It was fun to go back to like my first mic, which I hadn't gotten to do in Austin in like years, and still had a great time.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. And then it was just all over the place. I feel like the mics that I still love to go to in Austin are like the Velveeta Room on Thursday nights and Cherrywood on Tuesday nights and Shtick. And those are the ones in LA where I'm like, man, I wish there was like the equivalent of those. Because I don't know. Yeah, I have a soft spot in my heart for those places.
Now, do you have the soft spot because that's where you came up, or was there sort of a kindness in the room, we're going to help you make this better? Because, you know, you mentioned that was what was lacking in some of the open mics you've been going to now. Are those rooms that you spoke of in Austin really helpful when it comes to giving you honest feedback so you really know how to rewrite jokes and hone them?
Yes, I wouldn't call any, actually, I wouldn't call any good open mic kind exactly.
Sure, sure, sure.
I don't know. I don't think kindness is like an important part of stand-up.
Right. Sorry, my improviser brain.
That's okay. I'm like, oh man, I cannot even, I like would never describe any open mic as kind. I don't think. Would I? No, probably not. So, and like, especially like the Velveeta Room, is that open mic kind? It is not. It's like a weird room and it's kind of a shit show, but like, I love the open mic at the Velv because, like, in my experience, I think I've seen every audience there won over by like someone. I was talking to somebody recently who had gone to an open mic as an audience member with a group of friends. But it was like a 6 p.m. open mic somewhere in L.A. and the experience was not good. And it was like, oh, you just performed like a community service hour, basically. I don't know. I love the belt.
I like that your reaction to the word kind was hilarious and great and really shows me my point of view.
I think your point of view is so lovely. I'm just like, that is not how I identify with comedy at all.
Well, I mean, also, like I said, I didn't realize that when I did stand up, I'm doing air quotes. I did quote unquote stand up in New York City, but I did him with this weird avant-garde group, and the like open mic that I spent most of my time at was a reaction to poetry slams. And in poetry slams, they rate you 1 to 10 on your work. And she didn't like this.
Wait, they rate you in poetry slams?
Yeah. There are judges. There's 3 judges and they give you 0 to 10. 0, crap, 10.
I don't think
great.
I knew that. What a nightmare.
Yeah, yeah. Like right there in front of everyone. The audience can like it or dislike it, but there's 3 judges that like tell you where to put it if they decide they didn't like it.
I mean, I guess I'm glad that poets are also getting feedback, because how else would you write a good poem?
You know what, though? Poetry slams are kind of different. It's not like poems, like, you know what I mean? Like, there's no...
Yeah.
It's not like this poem's going to go in a book somewhere. I mean, maybe. But, like, most of it's about performing in a certain sort of rhythmic way, I find. That was the ones that usually won. Were the ones that had sort of a weird way of saying things. And you're like, cool, what, great. But
I love poetry slam boys. Yeah.
Yeah. But so Jen, who was the host of this thing, hated it. She called her open mic the anti-slam. And after every single person went up at the open mic, she would have everyone yell 10. She'd say judges and everyone would say 10. So everyone got a 10 every time. Thus, nice. That's where my point of view comes from.
That's great. I remember going to a poetry slam before in New York before I was doing like any kind of performance. Okay. And I feel like I enjoyed it. And I feel like it's like, man, if I had just gone to like two more, I probably would have started doing poetry slams and my life would be very different and terrible now.
I don't know. I mean, you know, you could be selling incense in the Lower East Side and having a very successful career.
Yeah. I do feel like poetry slams, what is that? That's like sincere stand-up.
Yeah,
like sincere,
I mean,
sincere, completely non-ironic stand-up.
It's like storytelling mixed with, rapping, you know, like storytelling plus hip-hop comes together to make a spoken word, that's what they call it, spoken word sort of performance.
Just glacially paced rap music, yeah.
Yes, exactly. when you went, you said you were in New York and you saw poetry slams. When did you live in New York? Were you visiting New York?
I was visiting, so after I graduated from undergrad, things were a bit tumultuous, and I had just been living in Yemen, and then the Arab Spring happened, and so I wound up going to Nepal because that's where I was working for a nonprofit, and one of their like flagship office was in Nepal, so they I wound up going there for a little bit, and then they basically decided to like close down the Yemen program, or at least that I wouldn't be going back. And so I landed in New York and I like didn't know what I was doing with my life. And I like was thinking about working in film. So I think I lived in New York for just like 3 weeks. I like crashed with a friend and like thinking about moving there. But yeah, I had a fun time in New York. It was like a fun, you know, early 20s, like wander around New York.
Yeah.
Kind of experience.
3 weeks. That's a long time. That's not like a short visit. That's like,
no, yeah,
real.
It wasn't like a vacation. It was like, I was looking for a job and there was media stuff in New York. And then like, I think what happened was I interviewed with a place that did like, cause I'd been working at like a media nonprofit in Yemen. And I was interviewing with a place that did like documentary filmmaking related to the Middle East. And they offered me like an unpaid internship, or I was at least going to go interview for one. And then eventually I was like, I'm not going to live in New York like and not make money. It just didn't make sense to me.
Yeah. It blows my mind that anyone in New York City can really, with like knowledge of the world, give anyone an unpaid internship. Like, okay.
I mean, I
get the kind that give you room and board, you know? Okay, sure,
yeah.
Sure. I don't need to pay rent and you'll also feed me? I'll work for you. That seems fine. But like, especially in an intern level, like early 20s, just learning how you're doing it. But like unpaid, nothing? Like, get out of here. Where are these people going?
Yeah, especially like if your offices are like in Manhattan. Like, what are you, yeah. And I'm like pretty fortunate. So I maybe could have done it for a couple months. But I think I was just like, I didn't want to work for somewhere like that.
Yeah. I mean, you'd been working previous to that. You worked for nonprofits. You knew how valuable money could be. So I'm sure you weren't like, yeah, let me give you all my time for nothing. Like, you know, so
it was pretty, that's why I wound up. So I went to Austin to get an engineering degree. And part of why that happened is because like, I came back from Yemen and I had kind of a range of skills and my Arabic was pretty good. And I applied for a job in my hometown working with like refugee, like social services. And they were like, oh, we love that you speak Arabic. It's amazing. We actually already hired for that position, but we'd love for you to come do an unpaid internship with us. Like, But I spent, like, I've already done an internship. I've, like, have some experience. I spent years studying a language. Like, is this really it? Anyway, that's my backstory.
Man, speaking Arabic should have, like, given you so much more value. You know, if only just because it's like, who speaks Arabic? You got a handful of people to pull from to help you. You're gonna shove this girl out the door with her? You're like, you had a particular skill that most people in the area did not have. It seems wild that they would have been like, cool, we already met a girl who speaks Arabic, so we're great. It's fine. It's like, get out of here.
I think what happened was that because of the financial crisis in like 2008, the problem was supporting like social services through like a charity model is that because of that, none of the nonprofits like shed their budgets. And then because of like budget, like government budget cuts also to programs, like a lot of nonprofits were like losing money. And so they were firing like their lower level staff. So I think it was at the time just like a glut of people who had a lot of experience who also couldn't get jobs. I mean, nobody could get jobs when I graduated from college. Like people just didn't have jobs.
Yeah, there's
I don't have like my like group of friends from college, like none of us have had careers.
Well, not in the way that they spoke about them when we were growing up, certainly. I just think careers are different than they used to be. Like, it's a different situation. You're not working for one company and getting a pension anymore. That's just not a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's more like you can have a career, but it's going to be on your own terms, and you're essentially going to work for yourself for most of it. So talk to me about this just for a second. I'd love to just find out a little bit more. You went to Yemen straight out of college. So you did get a pretty solid job that allowed you to travel. You said you're working at a nonprofit, and you mentioned that the other one that you were trying to get the job with was working with refugees. Was the Yemen one a refugee-focused social service program as well?
It was not. So I had actually worked for... Right out of college, I went and worked for AmeriCorps in Montana.
Oh.
And then this thing in Yemen, it was actually technically also an unpaid internship, although they did give me room and board and a small stipend, which in Yemen let me live, like, pretty big. Mm-hmm. There's not a ton to spend money on in Yemen. and so, yeah, that was, it was, like, a place that did youth radio programming, focused on like youth issues.
Wow, that's really great that this thing exists, that they're trying to get the voice of the younger generation out there. That's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Wow. So you mentioned that you were interested in social services and whatnot, but then you went to Austin for an engineering degree. How did that transition, or maybe I'm not seeing the connection? What was that in your mind? What were you hoping to do with that degree?
Yeah, I don't think there is a strong connection necessarily. I don't know. I've always been a person, like, I like a lot of different things.
Sure.
And I think I had some AmeriCorps money to do grad school of some kind, so I think I just decided to, like, take a couple of like math science classes and then maybe look at applying to a graduate degree in like environmental law or environmental policy or something, which I thought would be like somewhat more pragmatic than what I had already done. And then I like did well enough in those classes that I decided to just apply to graduate school in engineering.
Do you still use the engineering degree now?
I do not. This was actually, I published a satire article a couple weeks ago that was, as a Christian gamer, I only drink my wife's bath water. And and so I was like describing the bath water at one point in the article, and I used the wrong water quality word. I used turbulence instead of turbidity. And somebody, and like a chemist left into the comments to be like, I'm actually a chemist. And so the word you were looking for was actually turbidity. And I'm like so humiliated. I mean, it's ridiculous, but I was like genuinely embarrassed about it because I was like, well, that should have been the one thing I was still using my environmental engineering degree for, is getting the terminology right in this ridiculous satire article. But no, apparently not. So I don't know. Yeah, I'm not really using it. Oh, I sort of use it. I have like a shitty freelance day job editing science and engineering papers.
Don't tell any of your coworkers to listen. You just referred to it as a shitty day job, unless they agree.
They don't know. They don't know who I work for, like a bulletin board, basically. Nobody cares who I am.
Are you like editing papers of like grad students, like helping them edit to make sure it sounds good?
Yeah. So I'm editing papers by not grad students. It's like researchers around the world who do not speak English as their first language.
Oh, and you're so it's like papers, helpful because you speak a lot of different languages. Do you speak more than English and Arabic?
I used to speak Portuguese also, but these are not, it's all English language papers. So it's just researchers who don't speak English originally. But I'm not, the language skills aren't useful at all.
You'd think that, like, you knowing the way something is phrased in another language would help you figure out what maybe this scientist meant. You know what I mean? Like, you're like, what is this sentence supposed to be? You're like, oh, I get it. They have an idiom about blank, but we don't use that, that kind of thing.
That might be true if I was ever doing papers from those countries, but I'm also almost exclusively doing papers from China, Japan, and Korea.
Okay. That's fascinating. I wonder. Yeah, and you're just making it more like English grammar, basically.
Yeah, so better. editing language, basically. Not really anything else.
Wow. It's a fascinating way to make some money. And are you focusing, is that then the, if that's your day job and you're not like deeply committed to it, does that mean that you are currently deeply committed to developing your comedy career?
Yeah, that's the goal. I don't care about the day job at all. And I constantly think about quitting it.
Well, you can if you don't care about it.
Yeah, that is nice.
The beauty of a day job, it doesn't really matter, is that it's not like if you quit it, your career's over, because whatever. That's actually why I used to work for temp jobs, because then I didn't even have to quit. I'd just call up and be like, Susie, hey, this temp job sucks. Can you, like, get me a new one? And that was it. And then I'd say goodbye. And the next day she'd call me with a new job. Best day.
Maybe I should temp.
I don't know how LA temping is. But this was an
I feel like
awesome...
it might be interesting or fun. I don't know. Oh, it's a lot of answering phones, though, I bet, which I truly hate.
Yes. I mean, you're essentially, rarely does a temp agency hire for anybody other than like kind of the bottom of the totem pole. Like you're not going to occasionally be like the sales manager for a day. Like that's not what's going to happen. But it's usually super low stakes. And my favorite part is that they always think that I'm slow. Like not me. That's not like they walk in and they're like, oh, this woman has, you know, no. And what I mean is they think because I'm temping that like I couldn't get another job. So they'll be like, hey, sweetheart, do you know how to use this phone? And I'm like, yep. And they're like, okay, great. Listen, just it'll ring very occasionally. You know, you can be on the internet if you want. And it's like, okay, great. I mean, low stakes. You can find one where you're doing more fun stuff, but like my favorite temp job ever was working in the warehouse for Kendra Scott, which I don't know if you know Kendra Scott. It's a jewelry company.
Oh yeah.
And it's just wrapping the merchandise for Christmas. Like every Christmas they need more people because, you know, it's busier. And then I would get called in there and then just sit at a station, get handed bags of stuff and just wrap them and put it in a box to send to somebody for Christmas. I was like, I'm an elf. Look at this. Best day ever. Nobody talked to me. I mean, I had like one person at the station next to me. Easy peasy. So fun. And the jewelry warehouses mostly run by women. So that's fun. That was a cool thing.
Yes. Yeah. My first job was at a bookstore as a gift wrapper awesome. When I was a teenager.
Nice. Nice.
Yeah, it was fun.
There's something fun about that, too, especially because it's like, you know, you're either a teenager or it's like often like grandmothers who are doing that at bookstores. But like, who says they can have all the fun? Like, do it, right? Like, get that job.
Also,
might be short term, but it's funsies for a little while.
That place is out of business. R.I.P. Chinook Bookstore.
Yeah.
It was like the only good bookstore in Colorado Springs. And their wrapping paper was so high quality, and now it was really thick and like easy to wrap stuff in and really beautiful. And now I feel like I'm always wrapping stuff with like dollar store wrapping paper that just like tears if you look at it. And I don't know, I miss that good wrapping paper.
Yeah, it's tough. Though, that being said, maybe it was the high-quality wrapping paper that put them out of business, not Barnes & Noble. Just kidding.
Yeah, no, I think it was, like, it was owned by these two really old people, and then they wanted to retire, and they, like, refused to sell the store to the employees for some reason. It was really weird. I don't really understand what happened.
You know, people have an ownership over stuff sometimes. I've heard of stuff like that. I've heard of situations, like, even theaters. Where, like, they'll be like, you know, a lady who's running it, and then, you know, it's been her place forever, and then it's like, okay, well, don't you want to kind of go home and, like, live off of the money that you have for a little while? And, like, I get if you're the kind of person who's like, nah, I want to be painting sets till the day I die. I'm into it.
Yeah.
But if, like, you don't, and you're done, and you're ready to go, like, let other people run it. But I've seen people shutter the doors of many a spot because they're like, no, my pride says this is mine and no one can else touch it. So,
Oh, that's interesting. It's probably just like, anyway, what's in that space now? It's like a fancy clothing store expanded.
Oh yeah, it is. Fancy clothing store. Mm-mm. Nothing like some thick cotton to make you spend a lot of money. So you're in LA now. You're focused on your comedy as the way forward. What is something that you are working on right now that is exciting you? What's the like project or the thing, the idea, even a little kernel of something that's kind of like creatively pushing you forward?
I've been doing a lot of TV pilot writing.
Oh.
So one of the best things I've done in LA is I joined a really great writers group. And yeah, I love those people. They're all really talented. They write interesting work. And so, yeah, I bring them new stuff every couple months. And so I'm like doing a second draft of one project and then kind of like trying to figure out what I'm going to write next.
Wow. Are you thinking of yourself in the central role of these pilots, or are you always writing for other people or other actors?
No, I would explicitly not want to be in a pilot. So I'm not writing. I'm writing as like a, I'd love to be a showrunner someday. Mm. That would be like my dream job is like showrunner for an animated sci-fi comedy.
Nice.
And then the only performance thing is I would love to play the voice of like a robot or a computer in a show someday.
That sounds good. I like the idea of you being a computer. I would be okay with you being the voice of Siri.
Yeah, no, I did a Siri voice in like a sketch show and I was very on point. It was great. Anyway, this was my pitch. If you're listening and you're a producer and you want to pay me a lot of money to do the robot voice in your show, please get in touch.
That's definitely our audience for sure. It's the whole crowd. It's just them.
Yep.
Just listening.
Hollywood producers.
Love. Thank you, Hollywood producers, for listening. I really appreciate it. Austin, Texas.
Shout out.
They're like, how, you know what? I'm going to ask this 40-year-old woman for advice. That's what I'm going to do. Will she live in Texas? I'm into it. That's what they're always saying. They're always into that.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So it seems like, you know, you've had a lot of adventure in your life. Are you using a lot of these trips, a lot of the experiences that you're having in your past and now to fuel your comedy? Or is your imagination just teeming with brand new ideas? You mentioned sci-fi, so I wonder.
In terms of my TV writing, I don't think that much of it has been affected by my past, although I have toyed with, like, doing a project related to the environmental engineering work I did. So I've thought about that. And then stand-up is kind of all over the map. I have, like, a little bit of stuff about engineering. I have some stuff about Yemen. It really varies. And then, yeah, I don't know. Inspiration comes from, like, kind of everywhere and anywhere.
Do you ever hit a rut with inspiration, or is it just always coming? Do you get that now that you exercise that improv brain, it's just brainstorming all the time?
I feel like I usually have an idea going for something. I don't know. That's the nice thing about doing a lot of different stuff is, you know, I was kind of stalled out on a pilot I was writing, but then I was going on a 2-week trip where I was doing a lot of stand-up. And then, you know, if I usually have like a satire idea or two kicking around that I call and pursue.
How do you make it all happen? I mean, like, it's a lot of different work that you're doing. You're working on pilots, you're working on stand-up jokes, you know, you're working on all sorts of stuff. What kind of, like, writing work do you do? Do you, like, decide every day you do a certain number of hours, or how do you get it all done?
No, I used to do a thing that I've been really bad about lately, but I do feel like that would be what my self-help book that I would publish would be, where I was just trying to do two things a day creatively. So if that, maybe that's like an open mic and then I like write some pitches, or I like write a satire piece and I, you know, go to a show.
Is that your advice for people?
I think it sort of is. And then the other thing I do is that if I'm like in the middle of a project I'm writing, I try to write 500 words every time I sit down, which should be most days.
Oh, that's great.
Because that is a very achievable goal. It's not that many words, but yeah, that'll get you like a couple screenplays a year if you actually do it. And yeah. So in my experience, like, especially when I'm working on like a, like something for TV, I think like just like I try to finish stuff first and then like worry about if it's great.
Oh yeah, I mean first draft all the way. You just got to get that first draft out. The editing can be open to whatever might possibly happen, especially if you're like offering it to somebody and they're like, change it in this way and that way. And you're like, great, plenty of chances to do that now.
Yes. Yeah. I do feel like I'm in like a weird zone with my screenwriting right now where I've gotten a lot better and it's made me feel worse and more fearful about my own work.
Oh, sure.
If that makes sense, it's because I like that's now understand sense. A lot more about the things I've done wrong. And I haven't necessarily yet written like the perfect project that will like, you know, leap over all those hurdles.
You know, I recently
understand the hurdles a lot better.
Yeah, I saw a cartoon about that the other day about writing and how, like, the more you write, you get better at writing, but then you're going to plateau where you know what good writing is, but you still have work to do as a writer. So you're going to keep writing crap because that's just the process of what you need to do. But now, unfortunately, you know that. Like, you know that the stuff is crap. You just have to be cool with doing that. And I feel like that's the same, the process of that, of like knowing things aren't going well, but, you know, powering through them is, I think, a good example of sort of real life. You know, there's going to be times when things are going great and you're not worried about stuff, and then something bad happens, and, you know, you learn from the bad thing that happens how to get over that hurdle. But the next time that you see the it coming, you know, it's like, oh no, my budget's getting low and I don't have any extra money. What am I going to do? Oh man, I have to go back and use those budgeting skills that I didn't want to because I had been so good about having enough when I needed it. Ugh, this makes me feel so bad, like I'm a failure. But realistically, no, you're just using the skills that you have. Now you've got more skills, so that's good. Everybody's going to start with crappy first drafts. You've got to. If it wasn't a crappy first draft, like, you'd be a robot and you should be very concerned. Like, but like, you know, it's better that way, to be open about it in that way. And this, the little cartoon was essentially like, don't beat yourself up. Like, this happens to the best writers. If you get to the point where you know that what you're writing isn't great, that just means you're better. And you will then, because you have this knowledge, be able to fix that thing that you have written that you don't like, because thankfully now you have the knowledge. But I don't know.
Yeah. I think I also think something I'm getting better at, and that's made working very frustrating, is you can write like a funny, engaging 30-page script, and it's not necessarily a great TV pilot because it has to set up a show that'll last for 100 hours.
Yeah.
So it's like, I feel like also there's like, okay, is the script good? But then like, also, does the underlying idea have the legs to sustain 7 seasons?
Yeah. Plus, in this day and age, there's so much more that goes into what they're choosing, from like political climate to cultural climate to like what they've decided they, quote, need right now. Like, you know.
Yeah.
It's not always based on your talent or whatnot when it comes to people and their opinions of it. They're like, you know, oh, you know, this has too many men in it. And you're like, well, I can be whoever. I just wrote down these guys' names. It was not a big deal. And they're like, yeah, well,
don't worry. My work never has too many men in it.
Well, right on. But I'm just saying, like, you know, in the political climate, or the cultural climate, rather, it behooves you to have mostly women. Whereas, you know, if somebody writes something, it's like, hey, man, it's open. Like, whenever I write stuff, I try my best to write characters that are sort of genderless. I'm like, okay, what's an adventure anyone could have? Like, it doesn't have to be a man, doesn't have to be a woman. It doesn't have to be any particular, you know, like, from any country. Their skin color doesn't matter at all. Like, this is an adventure of a human being. Done. Because, you know, you can't pigeonhole yourself anymore.
Sure.
Yeah.
Although I think the joy often lives in, like, those specifics.
No, you're right.
Like, that's where, like, rich character backstory comes from.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right. So you're further along in this pilot writing thing. You're smart. That's an excellent point. I think you'll get through that. I know you will. Get past the point where you're like, you know, oh, I know that this is no good, but, you know, everyone has to have a rough time.
Sure.
I mean,
look, I'm not saying that the stuff I'm doing is no good, but it's just not like
up to par. Yeah, for your
maybe ready
taste.
To be an actual TV show yet. Although I've seen some garbage TV. I don't know. Usually, garbage. Even TV shows that are badly written, though, they do tend to be like, they do have that like series leg, if that makes sense.
You know what's funny, though? There have definitely been shows that, like, I thought when they first came out, like, this is going to be canceled in 10 seconds. Because, like, for instance, How I Met Your Mother. Crap premise.
Yeah.
Terrible premise. Like, oh, I'm sorry, you're building for the end? Great. Good job. If those two writers weren't already established in Hollywood, that thing wouldn't have been sold at all. Like, it was...
Do you really think that's a bad premise, though? Because I feel like that's a fun narrative device, and then you get to play with, like, dramatic irony. I think that's what dramatic irony is. I don't think anybody knows what irony is.
Well, I feel like it changes. From English class in high school to later in life, it changes. But you're right. I mean, like, I loved the show. Don't get me wrong. I enjoyed it. I literally even enjoyed waiting, you know, 8 years to meet the mother. But at the same time, I was like, okay, how are they going to build the idea around? It's essentially like, it's something that they say in improv where they're like, don't make the scene about one thing if that thing is never going to be there. You know what I mean? Never be like, oh, well, the ambulance is on its way. Well, that ambulance better show up in that scene, or else you're talking about something that doesn't matter at all. And so the idea that this mother was never going to be seen was like, what's the point of this? Why? Like I get what the stories are, but to frame it around a character you're never going to meet just seemed to me to be like, I don't know, a waste, or like an offer that never got met. And I was like, okay, show me the mother. Give me a little bit. But I mean, I get it.
It also does undercut the stakes for like every new character you make. You're like, well, this isn't the mother.
Yeah, or the idea that like in the first episode, they're like, he meets a girl and then he's like, but that's not your mother. It's like, ugh, you're going to do this every time? Yes, he is. He is. That's what's going to happen. Same joke over and over.
Every joke.
I mean, I don't know. Again, what's interesting about that is that like, maybe you're right. Maybe the people in the room were more like into that premise than other things. But when I first saw it, I was like, no, what? Get out of here. And I ended up loving the show, watched every minute of it. But like, I was still like, oh, this one's not going to last. There's just no way. There's just no legs. I thought. Turns out I was wrong. But at the same time, it really wasn't about the mother at all, or even about his love of the mother. So in my mind, the title or premise, like, pretty much just set up the idea that he was a romantic, and then we just let that go until they decided they were going to revisit that story.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's interesting because I also think it depends, like we were talking about, on like what they need. Like, what are other things that are happening on television right now? What are we missing? Like, if we have too many family comedies, maybe there's no families. Maybe it's a married couple that don't have kids instead of, you know, a bunch of kids. What's the audience? What's the audience listening? I mean, like, for instance, another CBS hit was Two and a Half Men. I never got it. I never got it at all. I don't understand why it was funny or good, but people loved it. I mean, my grandmother loved it. I couldn't believe my grandmother loved it, but she watched it every day. Like,
people do love it. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, and so it's like, sometimes I think I understand what comedy is, but sometimes I'm like, I'm going to write, and you're right about like the specifics of characters, because I'll say, I'm just going to write what I like and what I think is fun, and then somebody will come around that's like, hey, I also think that's fun. And I wonder, you know, I don't...
But even Two and a Half Men, what is, the premise is like a hard-partying guy lives with his, like, straight-laced single dad friend or brother in, like, a city. And that is, like, man, even if it's not appealing to me, that is, like, a seven-season series. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because you're right, it's essentially, oh God, what's the two people that are butting heads? The two guys in the 70s television show?
Odd Couple.
Odd Couple, thank you. Yeah. I was like, this is an example of the Odd Couple scenario, for sure. You know, uptight versus partying, and then they just threw a kid in to kind of add some flair and appeal to parents. They're like, I also have a child. He says that stuff occasionally. You know, that kind of stuff.
And like, the title's great. It tells you exactly what the show, I don't know why I'm raising expensive Two and a Half Men.
No, I mean, you make a valid point, 100%. I'm always open to debate about whether shows are good or not, because I think I'm not the person in charge. You know, I'm not a network executive, so I don't understand what these things are, but you're right. Seven seasons for sure.
It may not be a good show, but it is a show. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, it's all there.
I mean, it was so good they put Ashton Kutcher in it for 2 years. after after they lost a lead. They could have just ended it, right? But they were like, we have so much more to do. Crazy. I mean, that's such a weird situation. Yeah, I wonder. I wonder about those kinds of things, like what is cool, what is hip, what is the, like, what people are looking for. Because one imagines that it's changed daily, what it is that they're looking for and what they've found, you know, what other things are working out well, you know. I don't know. Should be interesting.
Sure.
Have you ever, since you've been writing these pilots, have you had the opportunity to submit them to somewhere or have meetings about any of them or any level of bringing them up to these people to hear what they had to say?
Like a little bit, sort of. I don't know. I had something in AFS last year, although that was web series script. Mm-hmm. So it was like short content. And I've talked to some people about those. I don't know. I've had like nibbles here and there, I would say.
Right on. Yeah, AFF, Austin Film Festival, is a really great place to get feedback, for sure. I mean, you can get it even if you're like, I'm only halfway done with this screenplay. If you submit it, they'll send you back notes. Like, and that's
awesome. Oh, I know. Some of the notes are, I feel like some of the notes I've gotten have been, I don't know, they've been a few different things. The notes I got on one project were like great and they were on point and like they felt really interested in the project. And then my notes on another project were like, these aren't the ones. I don't know. That is, like, learning to take notes is interesting because, again, ignore them at your peril, but you really can't listen to everything. So.
I think it is important to learn how to take notes, and even if you disagree with them, you're going to have to receive it and take it in a polite way in front of that person, especially if it's in person. And also, just, we were talking about the, like, writing and not feeling great about it, but what if you write something and you feel super great about it, but then you sell it and they rip it apart? Are you sad, or are you like able to be, I don't mean you specifically, I mean like in general, I wonder, you know, if you're unable to take advice, then how well are you going to deal with the actual reality of being a writer, where probably very, very, very likely they're going to have somebody else rewrite that script before it actually goes to be made.
Yeah, it does seem like you have to walk a line between, like, you do have to be willing to take notes and, like, make changes. But you also, like, they are kind of hiring you to be a person with a vision. So it makes sense that you have to, like, hold to a version of that vision as well.
Yeah. Totally. Well, this has been really fascinating to chat with you about. I love the that a lot of the stuff that we've chatted about has to do with writing and both your process and then how to deal with taking notes. I think that is very valid and super helpful for anybody out there who is working on their own screenplay or working on their own web series. Ella Gale, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Oh, can I give your, like, maybe newer people a piece of advice that I actually do think
is extremely important. Yes.
Is that you do not have to agree with a note. You do not have to take it. But arguing with a note will never serve you. I think that's, like, really true. Again, some notes are bad, but I think if you can, like, take notes well in the moment without arguing that with them, that's, like, the most important thing I've learned in the past year or so.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Because then people will be willing to read your stuff in the future, and you'll, like, maintain good relationships. And you also respect, like, that somebody took the time to read your work and to, like, think about it and to talk to you about it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a level of professionalism that a lot of people don't hold themselves up to. That's an excellent standard, and I think that that's really important. I mean, how do you become better?
It's extremely hard, and I have only gotten better at it recently. But, I mean, I think you learn by, like, the first time you give somebody notes and somebody tries to, like, argue you out of your opinion. It's just, like, you like see how pointless it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I've taught my fair share of sketch writing classes where they try to tell me what the joke is. And I'm like, no, I understand what the joke is. I just don't think this is the right way to communicate that joke. Sorry. You can do whatever you want, but
yeah,
this is what I'm saying. And you paid me to be a teacher to tell you. In the same way that, like, if you submit to Awesome Film Festival, you pay to have somebody read it. And whether they're like, I love it or I hate it, that's what you got. That's what you got.
I mean, by all means, go nuts, complain to your friends about the idiot, or a podcast host about the idiot who read your work and didn't get it. But do not argue with that person in the moment.
No. Good. This is excellent advice. I really appreciate that. That's good. Any other kernels of advice you'd like to share with the audience before I let you go back to your exciting life?
That's my only one for now.
That's an awesome one. Good. And what a wonderful thing to sort of cap the whole idea. We started talking about your satire, and now we're talking about screenplays. And I think that particular writing advice is super key to the whole situation. Awesome. Thank you so much for being on the podcast and sharing your time with me and my audience.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.